This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Searching for El Dorado.
And suddenly I was in possession of this knowledge about where he had actually gone. And it was really at that point where I decided to do something that was very out of character for me, because I am the least likely explorer in the world, which was to plunge into the wilderness and see if I could solve this mystery myself.
That's journalist and author David Graham talking about his search to find out what happened to the Amazon explorer Percy Fawcett and to find the lost city of Z. We'll talk to Graham in the first part of our show.
People who make $50,000 to $75,000 a year pay a larger share of their income to the federal government than people who make $100 million+ a year.
And that's David K. Johnston. We'll talk with Johnston later on about fiscal therapy, how the tax system is stacked in favor of the very rich, and what to do about it. That's all coming up on this week's show. Percy Fawcett was one of the last of the great Victorian explorers. Called the David Livingstone of the Amazon, he ventured into uncharted realms with little more than a machete, a compass, and an almost divine sense of purpose. That's what my guest David Graham writes in his fascinating new book, The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. A staff writer at The New Yorker since July 2003, when Graham began his quest to find out what happened to Percy Fawcett, little did he imagine that he would find himself in the Amazon jungle as well, engaged in the same mystery that drove Fawcett to the ill-fated 1925 expedition from which he never returned. They both went in search of the lost city of Z, the ruins of an ancient civilization in the Amazon, also called El Dorado, a place, skeptics said, that could never have existed. But it turned out it did. David Graham, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, in The Lost City of Z, you tell the story of Percy Fawcett and his ill-fated quest to locate what he called Z, which others have called El Dorado, the ruins of an advanced civilization in the Amazon. Could you first give us a thumbnail description of Fawcett himself? Who was he?
Yeah, he really was the kind of last of a certain breed. He grew up in the Victorian age, and he was really this kind of the last of these, both the Victorian, but also these amateur explorers and archaeologists who would venture into these blank spots on the map with little more than a machete, a compass, and an almost divine sense of purpose. And he began exploring the Amazon in 1906, and the Amazon at the time was really the last large blank space on the map. And for nearly two decades, he explored this area. And at the time, if someone explored that, many of the countries in the interior, like Brazil and Peru and Bolivia, they didn't even know where their borders were, and so they needed someone to come in and map them. And so that's how he first started exploring the Amazon. He then continued to explore it for nearly two decades. And during the course of that time, he began to gather clues and evidence that suggested to him there were remnants of an ancient civilization in the middle of the jungle. And in 1925, he finally set out to find it. And discover it, and he brought with him just two people with him. He brought with him his older son, Jack, and Jack's best friend, Raleigh Rimel, and off they marched into the wilderness, and they then vanished without a trace.
They did indeed, and that is very much one of the major subjects of your story. The other is really Z itself. But first, tell us about him. He was a very unusual character. Talk about him, and what were the influences that kind of shaped his life?
Yeah, he really was a very larger-than-life figure, and even though he's not remembered by that many people today, he was once this kind of titanic and colossal figure who really was a legend. He would take these parties into the Amazon and usually take about, you know, a dozen men with him. This is before he disappeared. And usually half his men would die of disease and starvation. Others would be killed by tribesmen. And yet he would always manage to survive. And this kind of fueled this legend about him. In 1912, long before he even disappeared, he helped inspire Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. And he's a man of many contradictions. He was undoubtedly one of the most daring men ever to explore in the Americas. He also could be merciless to those he was with. Because he was always immune to disease himself, he had very little sympathy or pity, and he was almost maniacal, and he would drive his men through the wilderness in just really kind of these very oppressive conditions. He was also in many ways very progressive for his time period, especially in the way he interacted with Native Americans. He refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances, even when they were being ambushed. And once, in kind of mad Victorian fashion, he had ordered his men to drop their weapons and sing God Save the Queen as he marched forward into a fusillade of arrows.
And he escaped unscathed.
He escaped unscathed, and it fueled his own sense of invulnerability, and as well as the others' people's sense of his invulnerability. I mean, he almost had, by the end, a god complex because he was able to survive under so many extreme and difficult circumstances. Many people used to wonder about his physiology. Was it what he ate? And some of it was just so slightly freakish. He had kind of great instincts. The other thing he did, though, was he really adapted many of the methods that the tribes used to survive in the wilderness. And by the end of his life, really lived almost like an Indian warrior in the jungle. He would paint his face, and he had begun to use all sorts of herbal medicines. And this really allowed him to survive when others couldn't in this area. But it also, in some ways, contributed to his death, because he really thought nothing could touch him. And in 1925, when he went to find the city of Z, he was already 57 years old, which was very old to be going on an expedition like this. And it also led him to the folly of bringing his son with him as well.
Yes. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, again, I think the sense of invulnerability led him, he kind of thought he wouldn't be touched. He was obsessed with finding the city. And in the end, he chose to bring his son. And his son at the time really didn't have, he had no exploring experience, nor did his son's best friend, Raleigh Rimel. But Fawcett thought they were ideal for the mission, that they were tough and loyal, and because they were so close, that they were unlikely to do what was so common under these circumstances and conditions, which was to mutiny. But they really had very little preparation for the ordeal they were about to encounter. And I was able to track down many of the letters and dispatches that Fawcett wrote on that expedition. And already you can see the ordeal having a profound effect, especially on Raleigh Rimel, who early on became sick, jaundiced, and terrified.
Now, you talk about those conditions. You have some horrifying descriptions of the sheer physical agony that Fawcett and his crew, not just this latest one, but the earlier crews, went through. Do you have the book there?
I have a copy somewhere, okay. Yes.
I'd love it if you'd read, because there's really no substitute, but to really listen to what it was like. I'd like you to read from the bottom of page 82 to the end of the paragraph, first paragraph on page 83, and maybe just set us up a little bit to tell us where we are.
So this is a reading that takes place. It's actually describing Fawcett's first major expedition into Amazon, which happened in 1906, and he brought with him about a dozen men, including a second in the command, a man named Chivers, and they were at that time trying to map the interior. Now, the Amazon is about the size of the continental United States. It's an enormous space, and again, because it was so unexplored, even the countries in the interior didn't know precisely where their borders were, and so they had sent Fawcett in to try to map this interior, and it was really seen by many outsiders as a suicide mission. And they encountered on this trip many predators for the first time, wild pigs. Even a frog, which is about the size of a coin, has enough toxins in it to kill 100 people. But I'm going to pick up here and describe really what was the main threat to this expedition and to other expeditions that Fawcett went on. But it wasn't the big predators that he and his companions fretted most about. It was the ceaseless pests, the salva ants that could reduce the men's clothes and rucksacks to threads in a single night, the ticks that attached like leeches, another scourge, and the red hairy chiggers that consumed human tissue, the cyanide squirting millipedes, the parasitic worms that caused blindness, the burny flies that drove their ovipositors through clothing and deposited larval eggs that hatched and burrowed under the skin, the almost invisible biting flies called piumes that left the explorers' bodies covered in lesions. Then there were the kissing bugs, which bite their victim on the lips, transferring a protozoan called Tipinoroma cruzi. 20 years later, the person, thinking he had escaped the jungle unharmed, would begin to die of heart or brain swelling. Nothing, though, was more hazardous than the mosquitoes. They transmitted everything from malaria to bone crusher fever to elephantiasis to yellow fever. Mosquitoes constitute the chief single reason why Amazonia is a frontier still to be won, Willard Price wrote in his 1952 book, The Amazing Amazon.
And you also talk about something called candiru.
Yes, the candiru is it's a little tiny fish. It's a little toothpick-like creature. It almost looks like a toothpick. And it is a real scourge. It's often known in Brazil as the vampire fish. And what it normally does is it latches onto fish. It's almost like a parasitic creature. And it latches and burrows onto fish and lives off them. But it is also notorious for getting into various human orifices, including a male's penis. And it will lodge in the tip and block it, and it kind of latches on. And if it's not removed surgically, the person will die. And Fawcett had described seeing people facing amputation or even dying from it.
And then I really loved the description of the maggots that would live in a joint and poke their little heads out.
Yeah, like a little periscope. I mean, the reading the diaries of Fawcett's companions was one of the more interesting and also kind of shocking and horrifying experiences I had during the research of this book. And I tracked down many diaries from his companions, including one man named Murray, who was a great polar explorer. He was a biologist. He'd actually gone with Shackleton on an earlier expedition. And he teamed with Fawcett, believing the Amazon would be easy compared to the brutal conditions of the cold and snow. And yet, as he went into the jungle, he was soon kind of under constant siege. And one of the things that he was invaded with were these little maggots, these almost parasitic worms. They would burrow under the skin. They were deposited by flies. They would then hatch, and they would then burrow under the skin, and they would grow, these little worms, and they would poke their heads out of their skin. And when you read Murray's diary, you see him slowly going mad. I mean, basically, he had always studied microscopic creatures, and now his body was literally being taken over by them. And he could just see literally more than 100 of them moving in and out of his skin.
And this was the environment that you decided to go yourself. Whatever possessed you, and weren't you terrified of these?
Well, it wasn't one of my wiser moments, and it didn't happen immediately. I became interested in the story, and I began it in a way that was much more suited towards my limited physical attributes, which was in the archives of libraries. And I had gone around the world looking for diaries like this and trying to basically tell Fawcett's story and the story of these quote-unquote Fawcett freaks, all these other people who would go in search of Fawcett or in search of Z, and they would also disappear or die. But as I was doing this research, I became more and more consumed by the story. And at one point, I had gone to Cardiff, Wales, where I tracked down Fawcett's granddaughter, a lovely woman named Rolette. And she had led me into her house, and we chatted for a while. And when I explained to her my interest in Fawcett, eventually she said, "Well, do you really want to know what happened to my grandfather?" And I said, "Well, sure, if at all possible." And she'd led me into this back room she had where there was this old chest, and she opened up the old chest. Inside were all these old books, and the bindings were disintegrating, and they were covered with dust. And I asked her what they were, and she said, "Well, these are my grandfather's logbooks and diaries." And she allowed me to go through them, and they had enormous clues about where Fawcett had actually gone in the jungle. And he had always been extremely secretive about his route because he was afraid that one of his rivals might beat him to his discovery. And suddenly I was in possession of this knowledge about where he had actually gone. And it was really at that point where I decided to do something that, again, was very out of character for me because I am the least likely explorer in the world, which was to plunge into the wilderness and see if I could solve this mystery myself.
Did you encounter any of these horrendous conditions yourself?
When you're in the jungle, I mean, a lot of the jungle has been deforested in areas where Fawcett went, and I was quite surprised to see some sections of the forest where he described cutting through dense forests, and the forest was so thick that he at one point got separated from his younger companions, and some of these areas were literally cut down. But as we move further north into the area where Fawcett disappeared in the Brazilian Amazon, the wilderness really remains and is unchanged in many respects, and there we certainly encountered many of the same conditions. Now, I had the benefit of many immunities and shots and elements of gear that Foster could never have imagined. I mean, I had various inoculations, but inevitably you encounter many of the same conditions that he did as well.
So talk about the Amazon that he went into to explore at the time that he did. I'm asking somewhat about the natural environment, but also the state of knowledge, the state of contact between the indigenous tribes and the outside world at that time.
Yeah, I mean, the Amazon at the time, when Fawcett started exploring the area, was 1906. Again, it's an enormous area. It's about the size of the continental United States. And because of the impenetrable nature of the forest and also so many of these threats, especially mosquitoes and diseases, it had really remained largely unexplored. And so it was this last large blank space on the map. And it really had for years and centuries haunted the Western imagination. And when Fawcett came into this area, partly because it was during the period of the Amazon rubber boom, rubber had become in great demand. And because of that, and rubber was tapped in the Amazon, and because of that, rubber barons would send in their men to try to enslave the Indians as workers, or if they got in their way, to massacre them. And so because of this, it was an extremely bloody period on the frontier. Many of the tribes had retreated deeper and deeper into the forest to preserve their cultures and way of life. And even once friendly tribes now often ambushed interlopers because of that and justifiably defended their territory fiercely. So this made Fawcett's explorations doubly treacherous because he had to head into these areas. And there was very little known about many of the tribes in this area. Even today, the Brazilian government estimates there are about 60 tribes that remain uncontacted in the Brazilian Amazon alone. Back then, it was certainly a much larger number. And Fawcett was the first white man to make contact with many tribes in the Brazilian Amazon.
I'm talking with David Gran about his terrific book, The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. Now, as you mentioned, you know, there was incredible brutality of the rubber barons, not the robber barons, but the rubber barons against the Indians. But there were also, you go in the book into the attitudes towards race, towards Indians. In fact, the idea that such Indians could never be capable of the kind of advanced civilization that Fawcett, Percy Fawcett, believed that they had had at one time. What were those attitudes, and why did Fawcett think differently?
Yeah. When Fawcett came of age during the Victorian age, he grew up then, and he was filled with all the very prevailing racist attitudes, which were extremely dominant at that time, to the extent where Indians were seen not only as inferior, but there was even questions about whether they were subhuman. And many of the early anthropologists from Fawcett's day, they would be sent out with chronometers, various kind of tools, like measure the size of the Indians' heads to basically try to determine their inferiority of their intelligence. And so Fawcett had been essentially taught that the Indians were incapable, almost biologically, of constructing an elaborate or complex society. And gradually over time, a second theory emerged in the 20th century that pretty much lasted up until very recently, which was environmental determinism. First, there was biological determinism, which kind of basically said people, because of their biological makeup, were incapable. And then later, the second theory that Fawcett combated was environmental determinism, which basically said that geography, that societies are captives of geography, and that certain conditions would simply prohibit a complex society. And the Amazon was seen as one of them, that the conditions in the jungle were simply too brutal to develop a large enough population to sustain a complex society with divisions of labor and political hierarchies. Now, Fawcett, over his nearly two decades of exploring this period, had begun to gather clues that led him to believe that these assumptions, both about the jungle and its people, were mistaken. He encountered many tribes that had not before seen white men before, and he was always struck by the complexity of their culture, the richness of their traditions. He also found that many of them had much larger populations that was originally assumed, that essentially disease from contact from settlers had wiped out many Indians and led to false assumptions about whether there could have been large populations in the jungle. The other thing he once found was he was in the Bolivian floodplains, and he was climbing these large earth mounds, and there were several of these earth mounds spread out. And when he reached the top of one of these earth mounds, he saw something sticking out of the ground, and he bent down to pick it up. And it was a shard of pottery. And everywhere he scratched, he saw other shards of pottery. Now, this was in an era before carbon dating, so he couldn't determine its precise age, but it struck him as extremely old and very refined. And that wasn't all. When he looked out between these enormous earth mounds, he saw buried under the undergrowth what looked to him like straight lines that were roads and causeways. So these were some of the clues he began to gather that led him to believe that indeed the Amazon had once contained remnants of a great ancient civilization.
And in fact, for example, Charles Mann, who wrote 1491, he actually lives here in this area and has been a guest on our show, he points out that, in fact, it has turned out to be true. You also discovered indications of this civilization. It's almost as if your attention shifted from finding out what happened to Fawcett to finding clues of this ancient civilization yourself.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that in the end became the more, in many ways, consuming obsession. I mean, the thing about the Fawcett mysteries, there really are two mysteries, or you could even in some ways say three mysteries wrapped together. You have the mystery of what happened to Fawcett and his party. You then have the ancillary mystery of what happened to all these other parties that searched for Fawcett and also disappeared. And then you have this third mystery, which is, was this a figment of his imagination, this ancient city? Could an El Dorado or a place like the city of Z really have existed? And for me, that mystery really did become the more tantalizing one because it has great intellectual stakes and great import. You know, there's one thing of knowing what happened to this specific party, this exploring party, but to know whether this ancient society existed, this ancient civilization existed, would really transform our understanding of what the Americas looked like before the time of Columbus. And Charles Mann, whose book 1491 is really a brilliant work, gets into this not just in the Amazon, but in other parts of the Americas as well.
In fact, he points out in his book that populations of possibly millions of indigenous peoples had already been decimated by European contact by the time the major Spanish conquistadores came.
Yes, I mean, what happened is, yes, I mean, one of the things that, and Fawcett studied this in particular, when the first conquistadors went in to look for what they believed was an ancient civilization in the jungle, a place called El Dorado, which they'd heard about from the Indians, and it was said to be so plentiful in gold that the inhabitants ground the metal into powder. They blew it through hollow canes upon their naked bodies until they'd be shining from the head to foot. Well, this clearly inflamed the conquistadors' greedy minds, and off they went into the jungle to try to find this place. And during those trips, thousands died. During the first El Dorado expedition, some 4,000 men died of disease and starvation. And other parties descended into cannibalism, some went mad. And after time, most people concluded that El Dorado, or a complex society, was no more than a delusion. And they dismissed the accounts of the El Dorado hunters. Now, even though the El Dorado hunters had not found their great golden kingdom, they had all described in the early accounts, these are the first conquistadors who had entered the Amazon, they had all described seeing large populations, enormous settlements, big roads and causeways, bridges, lots of pottery. Now, most historians had dismissed these accounts as simply the products of the conquistadors' fervent imaginations because later people came and didn't see these things. But Fawcett thought the accounts were too similar to slowly dismiss. And now what we are learning is that essentially these accounts probably were much more truer than we ever thought, and that the rapacity of disease, the rapaciousness of disease, was so strong that these populations, these larger populations, were quickly wiped out. And it was something that Fawcett speculated in his writings. He thought that the population had been decimated by disease, and that was one of the reasons nobody had found evidence of these settlements. And the decimation of the population was so large that Fawcett even wondered, because you know he couldn't even quite wrap his mind around it, you know, had there been some kind of natural disaster as well.
Now, you say that some of these civilizations are as old as 10,000 years, and that, in fact, they're changing the idea of the first inhabitants how the American continents, in fact, got settled.
Yeah, I mean, what is happening today is that archaeologists are finally coming in, and they're using high-tech gadgetry, they're using satellite imagery, they're using ground-penetrating radars, and they're finding evidence of ancient ruins. In fact, in the very places where Fawcett thought he would find the city of Z, one archaeologist has found evidence of 20 pre-Columbian settlements. And in one area, Anna Roosevelt, the archaeologist who's the granddaughter of Theodore Roosevelt, who also explored the Amazon, she found near a cave near Santarem evidence of a human settlement that goes back 10,000 years, which is twice as old as was previously thought people had occupied the Amazon. And it's so long ago that it's literally undercutting the theory of how it was originally assumed the Americas were populated, that people had basically crossed the frozen Bering Straits, and the first people to settle in the Americas were the Clovis people, and they had settled in North America around 10,000 years ago and then gradually migrated down southward. But because the settlement is as old as the early Clovis settlement, it's undercutting that theory. And now there's question, were there different populations that moved across? Did they move across at different time periods? And essentially what is happening is we still know very little. Our understanding of what is really there is still very little because we're just at the beginning of this archaeological revolution. But basically all paradigms are off.
We're talking with David Gran. His book, The Lost City of Z, explores the story of Percy Fawcett, the explorer Percy Fawcett, as well as Fawcett's search for the lost city of Z, or El Dorado, in the Amazonian jungle. Now, tell us a little bit about what these early civilizations looked like. You point out that, by and large, they weren't built of stone, and that's one of the reasons why they've been so difficult to find.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things we always think of when we think of ancient ruins, we think of, like, the Mayans or we think of the Incas, that it's going to be these massive stone ruins, and there just isn't a lot of stone in the jungle. And so the natives, inhabitants, manipulated their landscape using the resources that were available, which was often wood and earth. And so, for example, those earth mounds, which I described earlier, that Fawcett had climbed and saw his shards of pottery, one archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania named Clark Erickson has now gone into that area and done research. And he has determined that these earth mounds were, in fact, man-made, and that they were a way of overcoming the floods and leaching process so that people could grow crops in these areas, and that there were elaborate systems of irrigations, roads, and causeways. And he has said that in many ways, the manual labor that went into this and the complexity of the engineering rivals the Egyptian pyramids, but it doesn't look exactly as we would imagine. And in the area where Fawcett believed he would find the city of Z, in the Xingu area, an archaeologist named Michael Heckenberger has found evidence of 20 pre-Columbian settlements. And again, these used elaborate roads that were built at right angles, something Fawcett believed he would find. They had bridges. They had all these interconnecting roads, and these clusters of settlements usually had between 2,500 and 5,000 people, which made them about the size of many medieval European cities around the same time. But one of the things that's worth pointing out is, again, what we know about these early societies is still very small, and we're just really at the very beginning of the stage of understanding them. And for example, it was assumed that you wouldn't find stone ruins in the Amazon. But not too long ago, archaeologists found in the Brazilian Amazon evidence of some stone ruins and even an observatory tower. And so archaeologists are just now moving into this area. And again, things we think is the way it will be then quickly get undercut. And these discoveries are happening quickly now that archaeologists are finally moving into this area, and they have available to them all these new technologies.
And as you point out, their descendants are not gone from the face of the earth. They're here today, and you've spent time with them. Tell us about the Iquicuros.
Yeah, who were really wonderful, and that is the area where Fawcett disappeared, and it's the area where Fawcett believed he would find his ancient city, and it is in that very region, right near this old settlement, a current settlement of Iquicuros today, where Michael Heckenberger has found all these ancient settlements, and indeed the descendants of these people are still there. Their numbers are much smaller, and what's interesting is they have oral legends which have little details about these grander, larger ancient settlements. For example, one of the things that Michael Heckenberger has found is that in the ancient settlements where the ruins are, there were these great moats, almost like these defensive ditches built all the way around. They would extend for more than a mile in diameter around these settlements. And at the base of these moats were palisade walls, were these holds where they had constructed these palisade walls going all the way around. And the current settlement, the people no longer have that. But in one of their in their oral histories, in some of their oral legends, they have details of these moats and they have details of these palisade walls. Now they thought the spirits had built them, but there is this connection between the present and the past that you can still find there. And one of the amazing things in this area is the Quikrus really have done a remarkable job at preserving their traditions, and you can witness them even while you're there.
And were you there? Did you meet them?
I did. I stayed with them, and I lived with them for a period of time and gathered. You know, they had actually, what's interesting, too, is they'd actually help Michael Heckenberger work on some of the excavation. So they've really participated in the process. And so I was able to meet with Michael Heckenberger, the archaeologist, and also meet with them and be told about their history and their past to gain some understanding into what this ancient civilization was like.
So tell us about the magnificent Afukaka, their chieftain. I mean, you have a photograph of him in the book. He just looks like a very larger-than-life person.
Yeah, he looks like a great wrestler. And they have a real tradition of wrestling in the Xingu. It's one of their strong traditions. And he was a great wrestler, and he's built like one. He's a very formidable figure when you meet him. And yet, I should say, he was incredibly kind. And entering these areas is not easy because of the bloody history of the contact, and we talked a bit about that. The tribes justifiably defend their territory, and you can't just wander into these areas. They really function almost as countries within a country. And the Quikrus are part of the Xingu area, which is today an Indian reservation. It wasn't in the day of Fawcett. And the Xingu area is about the size of Belgium, and it's one of the largest swaths of territory that remains under indigenous control on the planet. And so you have to kind of enter these areas, make contact, negotiate your way on. And once I achieved that, because that was not easy, the tribes and the Quikrus in particular were extraordinarily welcoming and took me in, and they let me stay in their houses, which are these beautiful, they look almost like overturned hulls of ships, and they're just enormous, and they're much bigger than my house at home. They house many families, extended families in one. And one of the things that was always striking is when I was with my guide and we were trekking through the jungle, the conditions were always kind of miserable if we were sleeping in a hammock outside. But when you get to these settlements, the tribes have done such a wonderful job at adapting to the conditions, and they've built these houses that are extraordinarily cool inside. So I was able to stay in Afukaka's house, and there the mosquitoes don't seem to bother you, and it's just quite amazing.
So what was the single most important thing you learned in making contact with them, how to do that in a way that enabled them to accept you?
I think the most important thing was just persuading them of my peaceful intentions and what my purposes were. They are still constantly under assault from loggers and prospectors. And once they realized my intentions, and I had a guide who could make contact with them and had a previous history who could affirm my purpose, it wasn't that difficult. Once they really knew you would meet with the tribal council, once the tribal council kind of agreed and they knew you were there for good reasons, everything went very smoothly.
Well, David Grand, thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Your book is The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. David Grand has written articles on a broad range of topics, from New York's antiquated water tunnels to the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang. His stories have also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the Atlantic Monthly, and the New Republic, among other venues. The Lost City of Z is his first book. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.